morning. We will be in Genesis 22. A couple weeks ago, I did the first part of this message about the life of Abraham, and we called it Life Between the Promise and the Joy. So there's like that season of life where God makes these promises, and then we have to wait who knows how long until we see those promises come to pass. Today, though, we're going to be dealing with maybe the hardest part of the Old Testament, maybe the hardest part in the book of Genesis, and definitely it's up there as far as difficult passages are concerned. But let's open with a word of prayer, and then I'm going to ask you a question to think about for a minute, okay? And then we'll move on from there. Lord, we just ask your blessing on the reading of your word, on the reflection of scripture and the truth that it provides us. Help us, Lord, to be open with our hands to anything and everything in our lives, that we would clearly give it back to you as the giver, and that we would grow in our trust and our appreciation of you as Abraham did. And we pray these things in your name. So we're going to start with this question. When was the last time you had a nightmare that like stuck out to you? Nightmare that you clearly remembered. I'll tell you one of mine in just a second, but I want you to think about that. And how many of you were prepared the night before for the nightmare? Like you went to bed, you're like, tonight's the night. I'm going to have a horrible nightmare. I'm ready. Okay, so think about the last time you had a very strong nightmare. Everyone have one in their minds, right? Were you prepared for it? No, because that's the way nightmares work, right? You don't go into them expecting them, and they strike you when you least expect it. And sometimes they can have a long-term effect. Now, I had a nightmare many years ago that I remember to this day, and it involved my friend Phil Walker. This was 4 years before he got married. And for those of you who know Phil, nobody expected Phil Walker to ever get married. That was just like one of those like laugh out loud jokes. And when he got engaged, nobody in New York believed it. They're like, it's fake news. But in my dream 4 years in advance before Phil Walker got married, I had a nightmare where someone walked up to me and said, I'm going to kill Phil Walker. And all you have to do is look away. And if you don't look away, you're going to get shot. And the sad part of my dream is for half a second, I thought about looking away. And then I was like, I can't do that. It's my friend. So in my dream, I got shot and paralyzed from the waist down. And Phil got assassinated on his wedding day. And I woke up to this. And it was like one of those moments of like, what was all that about? Because in the dream, and as most of you know, right, in the dream, it was so real. It felt like I had lost a friend. It felt like I had lost my health. It felt like I had lost so many things in one moment. And to wake up from that nightmare was like, you know, it was nice. It was nice to wake up and be like, oh yeah, that's not real. But think about what nightmares kind of do for us. They remind us of the things that we can lose, right? That nothing in this life is guaranteed. Losses very rarely have a precursor. Very rarely is there like an email in advance saying you're about to lose everything. Loss happens suddenly. And some of the difficulties of what we're going to look at today is the loss that sometimes God asks us to give up something. And it's difficult, right? So we're about to take a look at probably the most difficult 3 days of Abraham's life, because Abraham gets this message in chapter 22. I'm going to read the first couple of verses and we'll just work our way through it. Genesis 22, here's what he is told. Sometime later, after Isaac is born, after Ishmael has been sent out, after his life has been radically changed, sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah where you will sacrifice him. All right, so this is a picture of Canaan. And anytime I think about the story of Abraham, I have to bring it home to myself, because you're like me and you grew up in the church. Like, how many times have you heard the story of Abraham? Have you ever let the weight of what was asked of him to settle into your heart? This was Caleb when he was like 3. And I cannot even, maybe 4, maybe 2, I don't know. I'm going to go with 3. So the weight of the request, take the thing or the person that you love and kill them. Now, for those of us on the other side of the New Testament, we're like horrified by that, because we know all the passages in the Old Testament that come after this where God's going to say over and over and over again, do not offer human sacrifice. The pagan cultures around you, they're all about human sacrifice. You as my people cannot be about human sacrifice. But this story takes place before any of those commands have come. So for us, we're looking at the Old Testament through the lens of all the scriptures that come after the storyline. But for Abraham, this isn't true for him. He came from the city of Ur. He came from a pagan Babylonian culture where human sacrifice was not uncommon. And so for him to hear this nightmare scenario was not shocking in one way, and yet in another way, entirely shocking, right? And here's our two shocks that we are introduced to, because for Abraham, his worldview of how he saw things, very different from how we see things. And so here's the two shocks that the Bible gives us here. First off, take your son, your only son, and sacrifice him as a burnt offering. And if you read through this, it's like God narrows it down. He's like, take your son. And he's like, well, I have two, your only son, okay, named Isaac, and give him to me. Give him to me. And the fact that God would ask this is shocking to us. Because again, we think of all the passages where God's going to give his son, where he's going to offer his son to save us. To ask for a son is just so alien to us, but again, not alien to him. And here's the second shock. Keep reading. Early the next morning, Abraham got up, saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place that God had told him about. And so here we move to the second shock. Abraham hears the voice of God tell him, offer your son, and how quickly does he obey? Early the next morning. And that is where we start to see there's something unique about the life of Abraham. He doesn't wait. He doesn't hesitate. And yet, there is a little bit of hesitancy here. If you could be instantly seeking to be obedient and at the same time not so sure, we see it here in Abraham's preparations. So you notice what he does? He calls two servants to him, but then he proceeds to do all the work himself. Did you notice that? He calls two servants, and then he goes to cut the wood. Now, for those of us who split wood in the wintertime, right? That's a thing that takes some time, and he didn't have all the tools. He gets the donkeys ready. He gets all the stuff ready himself. So you can feel the pressure. He's torn between two worlds, basically. The world of what he knows of God and the world of what God is asking of him. And so he's obeying very quickly, and yet at the same time, he's like struggling. You can feel it. You can feel it in the text and the way that it's presented to us. And here's where we start to have to wrestle a little bit with the story. Because the questions of suffering reveal a lot about us. Now, for most of world history, they didn't struggle the same way we do with the concept of a God asking from you stuff you would not possibly want to give up. For us, that's a newer problem. Now, it's not that God hasn't asked things of us, but we kind of have the perspective that he wants ultimately good for us, which he does. And so we kind of have this idea that because he wants good for us, he's always going to give us things we want. Now, most of world history did not have that mental picture in their minds of a God who's out for your good. Most of world history, that's not how they saw things. And so for us, this text is an alien concept that God would ask you to give up the thing you love the most. But for him, it was not such an alien concept. And you see it even in the way he responds. So if you take a look, most of what Abraham says in this passage really boils down to three words. Here I am. He's going to say something along those lines three times in this text. And the here I am, the commentators tell us, is a subtle yes. He's saying, before you even ask anything of me, the answer is yes. And we're going to see that in verse 7 in just a second. He's like, here I am. Whatever you say, God, you have the right to ask of me, and I will do it. So it's a tough thing for us to be able to process. It's a tough thing for us to be able to see. But here's where he starts to raise the question that we have to think about. Can God ask me to do anything? What is the things I can say no to him about? And see, again, we believe that God created the world and he created a good world, right? The book of Genesis is the only ancient account where God created the world and there was no opposition, no war, no bloodshed. I mean, you read all the other myths that are out there about how the world came to be, Greek mythology, ancient Near Eastern mythology. It's all like violent wars in heavens. And, you know, pulling out gods out of dead titans and like just crazy stuff. Genesis is the only story ever where God's like, I'm just going to do this because I want to and it's good. And he speaks a word and boom, everything happened. And it's all set and it's all good. Everything is good. And so for us, we built on this, that there is a good God who created a good world for us to live in. And for us, unfortunately, there's a very easy slip that we can take, that he made a good world for us to live in, and therefore, my happiness must be the ultimate goal. Now, Abraham would look at you and say, nope. But you see how for us, that is a subtle way. So when suffering comes into our lives and something we want is taken away, or we start to experience pain, and we're like, God, where are you? What are you doing? This cannot be good. We fall into this because he's good and makes a good world, that everything in my life had better be happy or else. That was not how most of the ancient world operated. That's not how Abraham operated. Because self-actualization, reaching the highest happiness for yourself, was not really how they saw things. And so for us, this is a challenge. When suffering comes into our world, and it will, where do we go from there? And if you think that life is all about happiness, suffering is going to shake that concept real fast. Here's the second one. The second thing that our worldview reveals that he did not have was the belief, basically, that humans can solve and figure out most problems. And if I put my mind to it, I can figure it out. I can solve the problems around us. We have science, and we have philosophy, we have technology, and we've solved a lot of problems. You know, like germ theory is a pretty amazing thing that we have solved in many ways. Being able to travel from here to New York City in like an hour and a half without a horse, pretty amazing. The fact that you can fly to China in like 18 hours, amazing. But here's where, again, the subtle problem comes into play. If I can't find a reason for something, there must not be a reason for something. If I can't find a reason for why God is asking me to give up this thing, there probably isn't a reason. If I can't figure out why suffering is in my life, there isn't a reason for why suffering is in my life. And again, Abraham would shake his head and say, just because I don't know the reason doesn't mean there isn't a reason. Because we're talking about the God who created everything. Is it possible that he has reasons and explanations that we couldn't grasp? Is it possible he would do things that in the moment we cannot understand? And this is where Abraham finds himself living in the struggle here, a very real struggle. And for him, it's a problem. Like, okay, I don't want to like downplay it and be like he was casual, like a robot that's just going to go sacrifice his son on a mountaintop somewhere. But you see, he had less of a problem with a God like that than we do. Now, we are thankfully given this. We are told right at the beginning that this is a F. This is a test. And what do tests really do for us? They strain our comfortableness. So, you know, I'm a teacher, so I give out tests all the time, much to my students' sadness, right, Eli? Sadness all the time. Tests are not a fun thing. But tests reveal where you are and what you know. Now, here's the question. How do you test someone's faith? You have to ask them to do something that makes no sense, because that's what faith is. Trusting God when he asked me to do something that doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we do examples of this with like trust falls and all kinds of stuff to show faith in a test. But if you are asked to lean back and fall, that's a test of faith. And it has to be something that doesn't make sense to you. So when God asks Abraham, offer your son as a sacrifice on the mountain of Moriah, it had to go against what made sense to him. It had to, or it couldn't be a test. But God also knows what he's doing on the other end. So many years ago, if you are under the age of an eighth grader, Upton Lake, plug your ears for a second, because this might ruin. I give a test on grace, and I make the students study for the test on grace. And just so you know, Sam, I may not do this next year, so be ready. I give a test on grace, and then they study, and they take the test, and they pass it in. And then to show grace, what do? Everybody gets 100, and it's like the greatest day ever. Except for like the two kids who studied very diligently and got a 99. And they're like, what? You gave me one bonus point? Meanwhile, the kid who's constantly failing is like, greatest day ever. Right? Now, I know what I'm going to do through that test. Do they? No. God knows what he's doing through this test. But on the other side of it, Abraham has no idea what God is doing with this test. But I just want you to notice, whoever wrote the book of Genesis, maybe Moses here, is reminding us right at the beginning that this is a test. God is doing something in this that we can't necessarily understand in the moment, and that that is okay. So this is the struggle. This is where he's at. Because again, to trust God when everything is good is easy. So when you're single, trusting God with your future children, how hard is that? Like, yeah, of course I'll trust God with my future children whenever they show up. If you're single, I'll trust God with my future marriage. It's easy to say when it's all theoretical, but God inevitably brings all of these things into our face through a test. So we claim to be generous. Will you be generous when there's been financial setback? There's a test. It's easy to love our kids when they're theoretical, but what about when they're rebelling against us and doing things we know they're doing just to hurt us? What do we do then? That's where the test reveals the truth, not what we believe in our heads, but what we actually want in our heart. And now the question for Abraham is, will you take the son of promise and kill him? And Abraham wakes up early the next day and begins the process of obeying that command. And this is where we move now to our next point. Because there's a difference between believing reasoned faith and hopeless despair. Okay, so let's take a look. Now we'll pick up in verse 4. So they get up, they load up their donkeys, they load up the wood. Verse 4 of chapter 22. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. Now if you notice, it goes from that whole three-day travel, there is not a single verse written. Why might that be? Why might there be nothing written about that three-day travel? How much talking do you think happened during that three-day travel? Not a lot. Because you have to imagine that Abraham is straining his ear to hear from God again. For God to be like, just kidding. Or, go back home, you pass the test. Nothing. No comments. And it was a 50-mile journey. And so here's a picture of Israel from this perspective. The red dot is Beersheba. It's like one of the furthest cities of that region before you hit the Sirius Desert. And he had to go up over some mountain ranges to Mount Moriah, which if you notice is very close to the city of Jerusalem. This is the same location that Solomon is going to build his temple on about 1,000 years from this point. So he's asked to sacrifice his most precious person in a location where Solomon is going to sacrifice thousands of animals later on for the removal of sin, which then raises the question in Abraham's mind, what is this all about? What is this sacrifice really all about? So he's straining. He's traveling for 3 straight days to get to where he needs to go. But he has this believing faith. So notice what he goes on to say. Verse 4. On the third day, he looked up. He saw the place in the distance. Verse 5. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkeys while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then what? And then we will return. Abraham has some kind of crazy faith going on here, okay? And here's where his crazy faith is coming into play. He believes that even if somehow he kills his son, that God has the power to raise him from the dead. Now, how many resurrections have there been in the book of Genesis at this point in history? Zero. There have been zero resurrections from the dead. He is believing in something that he has never seen or even heard of. But here's what he knows, and here's where his believing faith is. The God who gave me Isaac in the first place, who said with that suzerainty vassal covenant we talked about a couple weeks ago, that if by chance, I do not fulfill my side of the bargain, may what happened to these animals that were cut in half happen to me. God is saying that. So he's clinging to that. That this God who gave me Isaac is going to bless the world through Isaac because that's what he told me. And yet, he has this reasoned faith as well because he knows. He knows that God is going to use Isaac to continue the line. Now, again, the faith test has to go against logic. Otherwise, it's not a faith test. It's a reason test. And so he has this reasoning that the same God who gave me Isaac and made this covenant and passed through these cut in half animals back in chapter 15, you remember, that same God is going to do what he said. And I don't know how. And the author of Hebrews says that Abraham believed by faith that God could resurrect the dead. He just believed it. He's like, I have to believe that this same God who made all these things, all these promises to me, will continue to carry on the promises even now. So he takes the wood. And Abraham takes the wood for the burnt offering and he places it on his son Isaac. And for those of us who look ahead to the exciting conclusion of the cross, notice the parallels here. Abraham takes the wood for the burnt offering and places it on his son Isaac, and he himself carries the fire and the knife. And as the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, Father. Now, in the NIV translation, it says, yes, my son. It could also be translated, here I am. He says this, here I am, yes, my son. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Where is the lamb? Now, Isaac had seen over and over and over again his father sacrifice important good things, lambs, animals of all kinds, to this God. Now he's wondering, we're going up this hill, we're going to sacrifice, where's the sacrifice? And then Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. And so we have this continued movement of Abraham, that he is not, in his mind, sacrificing to earn God's favor. Because if you remember how this whole story begins, what does God tell him in Genesis 12? You have my favor. You are my person. I am calling you. You don't have to earn this. It's a gift. So he already has his favor. But again, in ancient cultures, they had this very big idea that if you sacrifice enough things, then God would give you what you needed. And it's like basically a manipulation tool. The more I give to God, the more he's obligated to give to me. And Abraham is wrestling with that here. But he knows at the end of the day, his sins can't be paid for. It has to be from God. And yet God has already said, I declare you righteous by your faith, not by your actions or by your deed. So there's this struggle. So again, he's going to go up the future, up this hill, into this future world that he doesn't fully understand to give his son as a sacrifice. But he also knows that Abraham's hope is that Isaac is going to continue the blessing. So this is Isaac, a picture of Isaac as an old man being tricked by his son Jacob. But just as like this weird reminder that Isaac is going to receive the blessing from God. And what is Isaac ultimately going to do? Pass the blessing on to Jacob, who will pass the blessing on to his son Judah, who's going to pass the blessing on and on and on and on and on until we get to the first 50. And this is this unseen faith that Abraham had. But why is he called the father of faith? Because he had so much less knowledge about who is God than we do, and yet he trusted him implicitly. He trusted him completely. And he believed that if God asks me to give Isaac up, I'm going to give Isaac up. Because I know that this God is worth my life and worth my confidence and worth my trust. And he sees with the eyes of faith what Isaac will be someday. Because God told him what Isaac would be someday. And so he keeps moving up the mountain. He keeps going up to the top of the hill. And then he gets to the top. Verse 9, and when they reached the place that God had told him, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. Now, this is the fourth altar that he has built. Every other altar he's built is because God has made a promise to him. And he's like, I trust you, God. I'm going to build an offer as a thank you. Can you imagine building this altar? Every stone he stacked is a stone basically ripping out the future of his own life. He's stacking a set of stones to give up something, not to receive something. And so far, it's always been an altar, a sacrifice of receiving from God. This is the first time he has to give everything back to God. And it's a struggle. So he stacks every single stone. He gets this thing ready. And then Isaac is bound. Now, we don't know how old Isaac is at this point. He's old enough to go on a three-day journey over a mountain range and carry wood up to the top of a hill. So we're going to assume he's not 5. But he's also kind of innocent, right? He's like, Dad, where's the sacrificial lamb? You know, like we've never done it this way before. And he is clearly able, probably, I don't want to overstate it. I think he could have got away if he wanted to. His dad grabs him. And, you know, Abraham's like, what, 110 by this point? Pretty sure a teenager could probably outpower him. So we get this idea, the text doesn't tell us directly, but there is a subtle Isaac giving his life up. And there is a subtle Abraham making an offering. And this, again, parallels the cross. Jesus giving his life up and the Father making the offering. And he binds Isaac up and he's about to stab him through the heart. And this raises the question that we all have to think about. Will God really provide for the needs of his children? Will he really actually do that in our darkest, lowest places. And Abraham is about to put that to the test. And the crazy thing is, he is fully committed. The Hebrew language here is, he has the knife over his head. And, you know, I don't know if you guys remember jumping off like high dives as a kid, or maybe not. Cliffs? Anyone do cliff jumping? You know, anytime you're like over the edge of something and you've never done it before and you have to talk yourself up to it. How many of you remember doing that? Some of you have done that recently. You know that point in your mind where you've jumped, but your body hasn't quite engaged yet? You know that moment where you're committed and you're like, it usually involves a breath. In the Hebrew, that's the idea. He raises the knife. He has clicked in his mind what he's about to do, and the knife is just about to descend. Just about to descend. In Abraham's mind, he has already killed Isaac. And this is where we get to the difference between the two fathers that are in this story. All right? So he reached out his hand, verse 10, took the knife to slay his son. So if you notice, he took the knife to slay. I mean, in his mind, it's already done. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven. And the first time he calls him, he says, Abraham, one time. What do you notice here? Abraham, Abraham. It's urgent. It's a repeated idea. Abraham, Abraham. And what does Abraham always say? Here I am. Whatever you want, God. Whatever you want, here I am. It's an implied yes. Yes. Whatever you want. The answer is yes. Now, what would it look like if we lived our lives with that as the driving? Every single day, it's, here I am, God, whatever you want. If it means talking to this person, I'll talk to this person. If it means asking for forgiveness, I will ask for forgiveness. If it means studying for my Bible test, I will study for my Bible test. If it means giving generously to the point of hurting, I will do that. Here I am, whatever you want. And that's Abraham's life consistently. Here I am. Third time he said it in this text, the world. Here I am. And then the voice goes on to say, do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. And again, the parallel to the gospel, God the Father will not withhold his son, his only son. He will give him, not to a great group of people, but to a group of sinners, to save us from ourselves, because that's the only way that this storyline ends positively. Because let's be honest, is Abraham a perfect human being? You read through the Genesis account, he lies at least a couple different times, at the very least, and we have this, he's a mixed character, just like all of us. He does good, he does bad, he sins, he's man of faith, he's like all over the map, like you and just like me. And if it has to do with him being able to enter God's kingdom, it cannot be by him. And so then we see this story. And then in these pictures, you look in the background, and most every single painting involving the sacrifice of Isaac, what do we see? It's like a sneaking spot. What's the thing that's in the background of all these pictures? We have this ram stuck in a thicket by its horns. In the background, there's this sacrificial ram that's being just kind of hidden back there. And suddenly we have this here. He says, don't lay a hand on the boy. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket, he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over, took the ram, and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. On this Mount Moriah, God will provide. Now, in some ways, it would be a little bit like more poetic if it was like a lamb stuck in the thicket, right? Because we've had this lamb conversation where it's like, where's the lamb? Where's the lamb? Instead, we have this full-grown ram. But that's even drawing to a parallel of what's about to happen when Moses shows up on the scene. Because there's this Day of Atonement. And in the Day of Atonement, there's two rams. One is the sacrificial goat sent out, and one is going to be sacrificed for the people. And it doesn't remove their sins. It covers over their sins for 1 year, so that they can be in the presence of God, this ram. And so again, we have this ram that's used as a burnt offering. It is not removing all of his sin. It's covering his sin. It's covering Abraham's sin. Just like for thousands of years, Israel would do this yearly Day of Atonement sacrifice. And that was where we find ourselves here, this Day of Atonement. Because this thing is called the Lord will provide, not Abraham obeys, right? And on this mountain, we have this picture. Because again, the temple is going to be built on this location where Abraham offers his son. And then 1,000 years later, there's going to be another offering that's going to take place maybe 100 yards away from this location. And on this place, Jesus will be lifted up. The Son, who is loved by the Father, as stated in the baptism, is going to be raised up and offered for the sins of the world. And just coming back to this text here, he says, this place is where the Lord will provide. And we need that ultimate provision. We needed it. And so we have this concept of credit versus debit. Credit is what Abraham's operating under. Credit is there's money that I don't have access to right now, but will, and I'm looking ahead to that, and I'm going to live now on something I don't actually have, but that one day will be there. Abraham is looking ahead to the sacrifice of Jesus, even though he doesn't fully understand it. He's operating in credit. But we, on the other side of the cross, we're operating on debit. 2,000 years ago, Jesus paid the price. Everything we need is in the account. And now we have our debit card of forgiveness. And we draw on what has already been done. It is that bank account is filled. And Paul will go on to say in Romans 8, if he did not graciously give us his son, will he not also graciously give us just what we need to get by? Everything. If he's going to give us his son, he's going to give us everything. And so here's the question. We have this God who not only gave his son, says, I will graciously give you everything. Can we say to that God, here I am. Whatever you ask of me, here I am. Because as I've said 100 times, God has never asked us to do something that he would not do first. Never. He asked you to forgive your enemies. He did that first. He asked you to give up your resources for the sake of others. He did that first. He asked you to love your enemies. He did that first. And so when he asks Abraham to do this, he's going to be the one who's going to do this first. Abraham does not ultimately have to give up Isaac. Now in his heart and in his mind, he had. And here we have this terrifying case study, right? Lived out right before us. And here we get to this very strange paradox a little bit, right? We have the Lord will provide. But then verse 15, the angel of the Lord came, called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, get that over and over, right? I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sands on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the city of your enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. He passed the test. Now, again, we get this weird mystery in the Bible, because if you remember in chapter 15, God said, I'm going to bless the world with or without you. Remember? Abraham didn't have to do anything to receive that covenant. He's put in like some kind of weird stupor, rushing weight of God's glory over here. He can do nothing except receive it. But here we're told, because you obeyed, now you receive it. It's a mystery. The sovereignty of God and your responsibility to obey what you know, to receive these things. And it's a mystery, and I won't try to explain it all because I couldn't. But we see the reality of it. But again, God knew what he was going to do with Isaac. He knew clearly what he wanted to show. And so here's some takeaways for me to think about. Hopefully you can join me in thinking about them too. We are finite. We don't know everything, but we do know that God enters into our. We have in the Old Testament, multiple stories of suffering. All right, so we have the story of Job, and many of you are familiar with Job. And Job, it has a very similar kind of thing, except unlike Abraham, God did not ask Job to give everything up. What did God do? He just took it, all of it, in one fell swoop. His family, his friends, his health, his wealth, it's all gone one day. And God never answers Job's question. Job's like, what are you doing? If I could stand before you and I could be the lawyer and I could present my case, I would win the case that this is not fair. I would win the case that you took things from me and I didn't sin against you. And God never answers that question. And if you know how the story of Job ends, what happens at the last part? 70 questions that God asks Job. And at the end of the day, here's what Job concludes. You have reasons I can't possibly understand. You're infinite. I'm finite. You're doing things I don't get. And as long as I have you, that's enough. And on one level, that's all true and good. But when you're going through deep loss, does it really help that much always just to know that there's a God who knows what he's doing? I'm not saying that doesn't help. And some of us, that's what we need. But for others of us, we need the Abraham personal touch. When God talks to Abraham, he's like, you can feel the pain. Because God, unlike Abraham, knows what all this is going to have to be in the future. In order for Abraham to walk off this mountain alive, somebody's going to have to not walk off that mountain alive. Abraham and Isaac come down, but Jesus comes down off of a mountain too, dead, pierced through, buried in a tomb. And so again, it's not that God asks us to give up stuff and then just says, figure it out. He feels it. And you can see it in this text. He feels the pain. And we are told three different times about Abraham that he is a friend of God. And this is where we get to this next one. Shared suffering unites even when God is one of the sufferers. There isn't very many people in the Bible that are called the friend of God. In fact, I can only think of two. Abraham, Moses. So if you're going to pick Old Testament heroes, you can't get much better than those two. But there's this like carefulness we have to have. Because when we call God a friend, we can subtly start to think that that means he's our peer. And he is not a friend in that way. But why is Abraham the friend of God? Because those two know the heart of what a father has to experience at the sacrifice of the son they love. Now, we, like Job, God takes stuff out of our lives all the time. And sometimes he asks us to willingly give up the things in our lives. But you know what he's never going to ask you to do? Allow your son to die in front of you and not do anything about it. But Abraham was asked to do that, and God will do that. He will watch his son be pierced through. He will watch his son be mocked and flogged. He will allow the sins of the world to fall on top of him. And when his son calls out to him, my God, why have you forsaken me? What does God say in response? Nothing. Can you imagine? What is your Isaac? And what if your Isaac was pleading with you? And your response is nothing. Because that's the love that God has for you. That's the love that God has for me. And so in some ways, it's crazy ridiculous when we go through hard times and we're like, God, you don't love me. Because we're looking at that and saying, you don't love me. I can't trust you. And that's the struggle. But when we go through those times, there is something amazing that happens where our hearts are unified. So the text we read, Philippians 3, 10 through 11, that we just read together earlier this service, right? I want to know God. I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection. I want you to notice it starts off with this very positive statement. Paul does a sandwich here. He's like, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection. Who doesn't want to know resurrection power in their lives? But then what's he go on to say? I want to know Christ, the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. Now, we want to skip those two, don't we? We want to go with the resurrection and then skip to, and so somehow to attain to the resurrection from the dead. But what's in between those two? I want to know Christ, the power of his resurrection, fellowship of sharing in his suffering, coming like him in his death, and then somehow to attain to the resurrection from the dead. We have to go through those things. But notice the fellowship idea. It's not just that we go through suffering. It's there's this unity and this binding with God when we go through it. And he says, I will draw near to the brokenhearted because he's brokenhearted. And he will go through those times with us. And yes, there's going to be times of death. Death to what we want. Death to our dreams. Death to the things we think we need. But what happens at the end? So, somehow, because to Paul it's still a bit of a mystery, which is encouraging. The mystery to Paul, it's okay for me to be confused. And so, somehow, to attain the resurrection in unity with Christ's suffering doesn't justify God before us, but it ultimately justifies us before God. Remember, we have this temptation sometimes that God is on trial because we live in a world where if suffering happens, something went wrong, and it's someone's fault, and someone needs to have a lawsuit brought. And it's easiest to bring God to the court. But we have to remember that the cross is not God justifying himself, God justifying us to him. And yes, there is a level of comfort that comes from the fact that he knows what he's doing. He understands the suffering. But the cross also reveals who belongs up there. Not Jesus. Me. I belong up there. I belong standing before God, exposed, naked of all my sins, clearly guilty, with no recourse. And yet, God still chooses to save. And that's the flip side of the cross. The judgment of what the cross represents. The judgment that Jesus received is what I deserved, what I do deserve, and what we collectively deserve. But he provided an alternative. So again, we want to be careful that we don't look at the cross as like God's defense. It is that in a way, but it's more than just a defense and why he does what he does. It is the means by which we have a relationship with him. And my last, we may not understand the reasons in this life, but we can trust that he loves us. No kid understands the restrictions placed on them when they're little. Our only real hope as parents is when we tell our two-year-old you can't have the sparkler near the gas can, is not that they understand combustion, but that they trust us. Like, okay, dad hasn't lied to me yet. Maybe I can trust him in this one moment. And when it comes to God's work in our lives, when suffering enters into our world, we may not get it all. And yes, are there reasons and books written as to why God allows suffering? And those books are worth reading. But in the dark nights of the soul, it boils down to, do I believe that he is who he says he is? And can I say today, here I am? Here I am. Do what you will. And to trust that he will do what is best by us. So as I woke up from my nightmare, something crazy actually happened. Working with Phil has its amazing pros. I miss him immensely. There are some downsides. We shared an office for 2 years. Some difficulties. One involved my leather coat catching on fire, but that's a story for another time. Didn't think leather could catch on fire. It can. But when I saw Phil that morning after having that nightmare, there was like this huge sense of relief that this nightmare wasn't real. Right? The suffering of that dream actually made Phil more enjoyable to me that day. Like all the little things, didn't even care. Burn on my leather coat, you're alive. It's all good. But those moments are where we need to live regularly for two reasons. One, the reality of hell and the suffering of what that is, the Christian, is a nightmare that is never going to be real for you, which then makes this life look a lot different. And the second thing is the suffering we experience. What if the suffering we experience actually will accent the joys of heaven? We wake up from this nightmare of life, and what do we find waiting? A God who loves us, a kingdom that's going to last forever, and the removal of sorrow forever. The C.S. Lewis, great quote, "Mortals say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it. Not knowing heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory." Another way of saying it, you wake up from the nightmare, and the nightmare actually enhances the joys of life without that night. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you that you love us. We thank you, Lord, that you would not withhold your one and only Son, that you generously gave your one and only Son to save sinners like us. And help us, Lord, to respond to that with a, here I am. Here I am, whatever you ask, here I am, I'll do. And when you ask for things that we think are beyond our ability, and we know you will ask those things of us at times, help us just remember that we do not know everything. Help us believe that your heart is good and that you are working out an end that is going to surpass anything we could even ask or imagine. We pray these things in your Son's most precious. Yeah. Would you?